is John Glenn talking about Oxfordpussy. I suppose, you know, a very important part of every Bond film is the pre-title sequence. It's something really that had been developed gradually over the years. I think with Oxfordpussy, I know I sat in an office with Michael Wilson, and we sort of threw ideas at one another and what have you. On a previous film, Moonraker, we constructed three Beady jets, which are these, I think it's called an Acrostar. And there was a pilot who used to fly these things called Corky Fornoff, and he came over to London to meet us and showed us a commercial that he'd shot for a Japanese company of the Acrostar flying through an empty hangar. And I explained to him that what's very important in a Bond film is you have to involve the audience in any stunts, and therefore the only way we could make that exciting would be if we filled the hangar up with all kinds of people and aeroplanes and made it really hazardous and create some suspense. And of course he was insistent that one, he couldn't possibly fly his plane through the hangar with any people inside, and most dangerous stunt. But unfortunately it's over so quickly and it doesn't look very exciting. So there and then decided we'd use the Acrojet, but we'd not fly it for real through the hangar. We'd actually generate our own stunt. So we called in the special effects guys. John Richardson came in, and we talked about it, and we went to the Peter Lamont, our production designer. We went down to the Pimer Studios, and we got these three Acrojets out and had a look at them, and they really were quite tiny aeroplanes. John then got a Jaguar XJ6, and he cut the body off of it and just had the sort of chassis and strengthened it all up, and he mounted on it an arm, a pole arm, from which he could lie flat on the vehicle and operate the tilt controls. This enabled us to put Roger Moore up on the actual plane and actually drive it through the hangar and disguise the pole arm in the car with lots of people running backwards and forwards. If you examine it closely, you'll see how we've cleverly disguised the motor car so it appears to be flying. We also then made a foreground miniature of the exterior of the hangar. We put a phony door in the foreground which didn't move, which was placed about 5 feet from the camera in miniature, and then the far door, which merged with the foreground door. We used troops and that trying to close the door as the BD jet approaches. That was probably a 5 foot model, and John Richardson very cleverly used a rig so he could angle it so that it went from the wings went from being horizontal with the ground to vertical. And as the door is closing, we have the additional suspense of will he get in the door before he smashes into the closed door. And it worked so well, we decided we'd do the same on the exit as well. That was very, very, very successful foreground miniature sequence, and used every device we could think of. At that time, strangely enough, we were shooting this at Northolt Aerodrome, a place where a lot of the Bonds have shot sequences. When we built the polo ground and the military complex at Northolt, we had palm trees which had to be raised and lowered every time a plane landed. So it's an operational aerodrome. Roger Moore had a very good, I think his name was Ken Somerville, very good double, which he'd used on The Saints and various other series. And we got Ken out of retirement and brought him in, and he was kind of like a very much like Roger in build and stature, an incredible sort of double. And we were able to use the idea that Bond impersonates this officer, this officer in some South American country. We then sent Phil Ressler, the second unit director, to America, where it's very easy to shoot aerial sequences. Somehow the weather's better and the permissions, and they had the space. And Phil shot a whole series of shots of the BD jet flying through canyons and under bridges, and generally very exciting material. This was, of course, combined with shots we did in the studio, where John Richardson constructed a model aeroplane and towed a firework behind it. This was my suggestion. I did it as a sort of a half joke to John, and he thought about it for a while, and then he developed literally a firework which he towed behind his model aeroplane, and he got his expert pilots we've used on several other films. And over at Pinewood Studios, they must have wondered what we were doing to see this model aeroplane cavorting around the sky, trailing the rocket. But of course, it looked as though it was a missile which was about to hit them at any time. We used several models in the sequence, including a very large model, which again John shot, which was shot on the back lot of Pinewood, of the hangar blowing up. And it's a strange story, really, with where the BD jet comes up to the petrol station, which is kind of the payoff, and lands in the road, and he goes up to the old attendant, and he says, "Fill her up," you know, which is kind of funny. And because the film was quite long, and the opening sequence was quite long, I was looking for places to exit the sequence. And at one time, I did cut that end tag off where he said, "Fill her up." And I just happened to be with my family down at the South Coast one weekend, and went in the local cinema, and lo and behold, there was a trailer for the upcoming Octopussy coming this summer. And in the trailer, Morris Binder had put in that very shot of the petrol station and saying, "Fill her up," and he got a huge laugh, although there were only a dozen people in the cinema. So I immediately went back on Monday morning and put it back in the film. All I wanted was a sweet distraction for an hour or two. Had no intention to do Binder's been doing our titles for many years, and it's kind of famous style. And you know, many times they talked about changing the style of our titles. Like all artists, he had to be in the right mood, and he couldn't tell people ahead of time really what equipment he wanted, how many people he wanted, and you know, he was pretty, for the production company, he was pretty frustrating working with him. But he was a bit of a genius, Morris, and it was well worth going along with all the aggravation, I think. But we were very lucky to get Rita Coolidge to sing the theme song for us. And as usually happens when you do the music, ideally from Morris's point of view, he would have the music before he started doing his titles. But of course, you know, by the time it's shot in America and what have you, and it's mixed, we don't get the title song until we're in the last stages of mixing the tracks together. So it's too late for Morris. So he has to kind of adjust his work and imagine what the song's going to be like, and kind of adjust the titles at the last moment. I think with Rita Coolidge at that time was, you know, her kind of song, I suppose, was it was a ballad, and ballads are very difficult these days with all the youngsters and that to promote. But it's a song that's gained in reputation as the years have gone by. There's a funny story, I think, with Morris. Morris was one of those guys, he was always saying to me, you know, I must take you and your wife out for dinner, you know, and what have you, and it never came about. When Morris died many years later, I had a call from, I was working in Hollywood, and I had a call from, I think it was the Independent, and they asked me to do an obituary, which I stopped work and I did right away, and I said, when do you need it? They said, immediately. So I wrote the obituary and I faxed it to them, and thought, you know, nothing more. They sent me the article and what have you. About 3 weeks later, a check arrived for, I think it was for $100 or something of that nature, or even less, about $60 I think it was. I didn't expect to get paid for it, but the check arrived. And I went, that evening I went out to dinner with my wife, and we went into Beverly Hills and had a nice meal. And the uncanny thing was, when the bill came up, it was the exact amount of money of the check was written out for, $60.25 or something, you know, absolutely uncanny. It made my hair stand up on the back of my head. So Morris did buy us a meal after all.
Ambassador?
We should go, my dear.
Moneypenny had been played by Lois Maxwell for many years, and a very, very difficult act to follow. And she was approaching the end of playing that particular part. It really required a younger person. And all the time, of course, while we were making this film, you know, there had been talk that Roger was going to pack it in as well, which, you know, was a possibility. And all this used to happen while we were in pre-production. And we were already looking for someone to replace Lois. And she was very difficult to replace, I must say. I looked at lots of actresses. Welcome to you. We decided in this instance that we'd try and introduce an assistant, Penelope Smallbone. And James Clavell's daughter fitted the role, a very beautiful girl. And much to, I think, Lois's chagrin, if you like, she she played a scene which was written carefully to get a little rivalry between the two of them. In the event, she didn't go on to become the new Miss Moneypenny. Part was given to someone else, but again, we had, unfortunately, we had lost Bernard Lee, who played M. And again, this happens on films, and you have these well-loved characters that go on for many films, and it's very, very difficult to replace them because they're so strong in the public's affection. Robert Brown came in and did a sterling job, I thought. He's an old friend of Roger's, and indeed, Roger suggested him for the part. I think they'd worked on Ivanhoe together and lots of other films. They were great friends. So, all you know, at the end of the day, Bernard Lee could never be replaced, of course. A very, very fine actor that I first worked with on The Third Man, one of the first films I worked on.
They usually turn up out of interest or perhaps...
The Fabergé egg was an incredible prop and a thing of great beauty, and had little... Not only did it have the egg, but it had little things built inside it. Very intricate. Of course, we were going to site this film in India. There were several reasons for it. A, it was a location we hadn't used before. Secondly, one of the writers in the early stages was George MacDonald Fraser, who was renowned for his Flashman books, which were all set in India. And so it seemed a natural fit somehow. I think from a production point of view, the films were costing more and more, although ours were very efficient operations. And, you know, when we first budgeted Octopussy, it was going to be something like $36 million. And one of the ways that we could actually economize on this was to, in fact, buy frozen rupees. So we negotiated with the Indian government, and they were very keen for a James Bond film to go to India. And they, in fact, gave us permission to buy up a certain percentage of the frozen rupees that were sloshing around in Hollywood. So some of the major distributors in Hollywood actually sold us at a big discount, sold us some rupees. And this helped us to keep the budget down to about $32 million.
I remind you, the committee, of our overwhelming superiority...
The typical James Bond has a typical James Bond set, and the Kremlin was no exception. Peter Lamont, the production designer, really excelled himself with the set. It was so amazing when I first walked Tom, and he showed me his masterpiece. It was complete with a revolving podium and a screen that revealed on the wall the state of the East versus the West, and an actor that had been recommended to me, and I think it was Barbara Broccoli was the one that really found him, was Stephen Burkoff. We went along to see one of his plays in one of the art theatres in town. And I was so impressed with the man, so impressed with his rather, shall we say, extravagant performances, but he is a force on the screen.
We have played out a variety of attack strategies on the new Kultsov computer and find that a lightning thrust by 10 armored divisions from the north and by 5 more through Czechoslovakia leads to total victory in 5 days against any possible defense scenario.
Walter Gittau, who was playing the head of the KGB as usual, his eyebrows went higher and higher as he listened to Stephen Burkoff ranting away. And Walter, being a good old trooper, went up and matched him word for word. So, I think a very successful scene, and Peter's set was absolutely beautiful. The guy that played Brezhnev, I'd seen on a TV series, a documentary on the BBC, and we got him down, and indeed he was a double for Brezhnev, and gave the scene a good feeling of authenticity.
I wish to tell you...
World socialism will be achieved peaceably. Our military role is strictly defensive.
Duh?
Is that understood, General Orlov? General Gogol, would you continue?
Thank you, Commander Chairman. I will now turn to the specifics of my report.
Tell him I will be there as quickly as possible.
Yes.
Kremlin art repository is quite famous. All the Tsarist treasures were stored in Moscow, and it was well-known fact that they had stuff there which was unbelievable in value. And Peter Lamont again used a not a foreground miniature this time. He used a miniature set. When you look at the set, all the vaults, etc., in the distance, he very cleverly, with his brother Michael, designed a perspective set. In other words, it was kind of miniaturized so that it gave a feeling of great depth and distance. The treasures there took a lot of finding, and the set dresser and Peter and everyone else scoured all the warehouses, and we borrowed treasures from everybody to make it look authentic.
A superb green gold imperial Easter egg by Carl Fabergé. Enameled in translucent green, enclosed by gold laurel leaf trellis, set with blue sapphires and four-petaled gold flowers with diamonds.
How much should it fetch?
£250,000-£300,000. Anything more would be crazy.
Used by Tsar Nicholas in 1897 in Moscow. Property of a lady.
Well, there are quite a few ladies here.
Sotheby's were very good to us and gave us full cooperation. We used their staff to advise us on the correct procedures of the auction. We shot the exterior of Sotheby's on a Saturday morning on our way to Peterborough to start shooting on the railway scene. And we just stopped off and got our exterior shots in a couple of hours before proceeding to Peterborough.
Now, there is a lady.
£220,000. £240,000.
James, stick to the business in hand.
£260,000. £280,000. £300,000. And 20? Are you bidding, sir? £320,000.
Louis Jourdan was an interesting character. He, of course, had been such a famous heartthrob in France and in Hollywood. I remember Gigi and all those films, which were absolutely amazing. He was an icon, really, and now he was a friend of Cubby Broccoli's, and Cubby suggested to me that we should interview him, and he met him recently at a party and said how good he looked and how keen he was to do a Bond film. Well, who isn't? I think the most coveted role for almost any actor is the villain, and it certainly appealed to Louis. And I met him, and indeed we cast him straight away. He has a kind of a dark sort of complexion, and he's extremely handsome. It has a sort of a quality of stature, which an assurance, which is very important for a Bond villain.
I have 475. £500,000. I have £500,000. All done? Any more? Yours, sir. £500,000. The next lot is number?
He could have been stuck with it.
I doubt it. He had to buy it.
But why? That's what I intend to find out.
Of course, M's office is, very special with the padded door. I mean, it runs throughout the series. I don't know who invented it originally. I suppose it might be true that top security places are soundproofed. But Ken Adam probably got the padded door, and it was in the red plush leather. You know, it was a thing that we carried around with us. I remember when we shot in Paris later on in Moonraker, the set was actually packed up and shipped from England to France and re-erected on the stage in Biencourt Studios in Paris. So, the mellow wood and the richness of the set. Some people have said it looked very much like Cubby's office in London and also at Palmer Studios. I think on reflection it probably did. You know, certainly the desk, the big oversized desk and the nice leather furniture was a feature of Cubby's office. and gave you a feeling of well-being, you know. And I think that's important, you know, to kind of live the Bond saga, if you like, even when you're making the movie. India is a fabulous location. It's so rich in history, and the buildings are so beautiful. And I was determined to use the Taj Mahal in the film. And I had on the recce, I went to the Taj, and I was with Arthur Worcester, my second unit director, and we went. I'd never been there before, and we had a pretty horrendous drive to Agra. It's like 250 miles or so from Delhi. On a very rough road, and there were accidents everywhere, and very colourful country. And so in the end I decided that the helicopter that delivers Bond to the lake at Udaipur would sweep past the Taj Mahal and land straight on the lake in Udaipur, which is 250 miles away. Vijay Armitage, the famous tennis player, was a friend of Cubby's and Barbara's and Dana's, and they brought him down to the studio and said, you know, maybe we could use him in the movie. The only part I could think of was the snake charmer agent, their man in India, if you like. And I mentioned this to Vijay, and he said, oh, I hate snakes. And in fact, we all laughed so much, we decided to put the line in the film. So he became the snake charmer, and together with quite a number of us on the unit, we were all a bit terrified of these snakes. And when we came to shoot the scene, I always remember the snakes were running away because they never perform as they're supposed to perform, and the snakes were running off in every direction. And it was really funny to see Vijay together with myself going around and grabbing these snakes and shoving them back in the basket, whereas a month before we wouldn't have gone anywhere near them. But they told us, the snake charmer had convinced us that these snakes had been milked the previous morning, so that their venom was inactive, if you like. I hope he was right, because we didn't get a bite to put him to the test.
Afternoons and evenings here at the hotel casino.
As a guest, you're automatically...
The lake at Udaipur was the setting for the palace where Octopussy lives with all her girls who work in the circus as well. So this was her hideaway, and we were very fortunate because the Maharaja of Udaipur was just converting his palace, which was separate to Octopus's palace on the mainland, converting it to a 5-star luxury hotel, and it wasn't complete when we arrived, so we didn't have any problem with other guests and etc. to throw out, and we were able to dress it. Peter Lamont and his crew made a fine job of dressing all the outside areas. The interiors, of course, we would shoot at Pinewood Studios. Above the lake, you'll see there's what they call the Summer Palace, and that was in quite a good state of repair, although we could only use the exteriors. Again, we used the Pinewood Studio facilities to do all the interiors. But another feature, of course, we found out was that there had been, in fact, a boat which used to sail on the lake and was propelled by oars, and the remains of it we've discovered. And Mike Turk was brought in, and we actually rebuilt it completely, this love boat, and Octopus's girls used to row it across the lake to deliver anybody to her fortress island. Every Bond film has to have a casino sequence, doesn't it? It's essential. This was no exception. And when I first suggested to Roger that he should be driving around Udaipur in his white tuxedo with a bow tie, he thought I was quite crazy. And I said, no, it looked absolutely fantastic. It's the last thing in the world you would expect to find in India in the middle of the day, is a guy being driven around in a 3-wheel taxi dressed for the casino. And it proved to be a big success. No one even thinks twice about it.
Shall we have another game, Major? Same stake?
Cubby and Roger would occupy their waiting time, if you like, playing backgammon. And in this scene, we actually use backgammon in the sequence. And Cubby was my technical advisor. It did help an awful lot that they played backgammon, the pair of them, because there is a lot of waiting time for the actors. And, you know, it's good that Cubby's aware of that. And he used to enjoy playing for quite high stakes, I should imagine. I don't know what the position was at the end of the film, who was winning and who was losing, but I should think it was pretty much even Stevens.
6-1, that should fit.
Well,
looks like the Major's got him.
Why don't we make it interesting, Major? A double to 100,000 rupees.
I can't accept. Not with your luck. You win.
Well, I would have taken that double myself.
Then why don't you take over the Major's position? Mr.
Bond. James Bond. Thank you, I'd be delighted.
100,000 rupees, then. Double six. It was not such a good double to accept after all, was it?
Double.
Of course. You can only win with a double six. The stake is 200,000 rupees. Do you have the cash?
Think that this should be...
Yeah, Louis Jourdan's assistant was a very fine Indian actor called Kabir Bedi, who had moved to Hollywood and was brought to our attention there. Very, very good looking guy, and he came over to Pinewood, and all the girls swooned in the office and asked for his autograph, and generally made a fuss of him. And very nice man, good at action, fine stature, and he was a great asset to us on the film. You know, to get a man like that with the experience he had was quite a find, and the casting people did a great job in finding him. The action sequences are so important on a Bond movie, and Bob Simmons, of course, had been with all the Bonds from the very beginning, and used to double for Sean Connery, and was a great friend of Sean's, I believe. And you know, he was such an asset to have a guy of his experience. Without a doubt, he was one of the finest stuntmen in the world. And you know, I'd worked with him, you know, when I was doing second unit on the Bonds, and he'd always been a great help to me, and been absolutely friendly, always giving me good advice. I remember on the I think it was A Spy Who Loved Me, on the train sequence, there was a scene there where Richard Kiel was thrown out of the window of the train, and Bob Simmons decided that he would double it himself. Sometimes he would delegate to Martin Grace, for instance, to do these things, but he was such an expert at being thrown through windows. And I questioned him about it, and he said, "Oh, I'm going to use real glass, real plate glass," and all he did was put one scratch across the glass just to weaken it, and then he was hurled through the window and spent the rest of the afternoon picking pieces of glass out of his back, but I thought nothing of it, really. Another man who had become part of the Bond team was Remy Julien, the French stunt driver team. Remy I'd first met on the Italian job when I was an editor, and he didn't speak very much English, Remy, but somehow when you get an action director and a stuntman together, you don't really need to speak the same language. You just draw lots of pictures, and we seem to understand each other very well. Terrific stuff, and he had his team in India with us, and he had special three-wheeled taxis made with boosted engines and boosted suspension, and others that were capable of carrying cameras, and wasn't sufficient just to take one of the three wheel taxis. Each taxi has to be for a specific job and has to be engineered accordingly, and this is Remy's strength on his organization. And he has half a dozen drivers, including his two sons, and they did a fantastic job. They were trained by the master, shall we say. Having Vijay in the sequence, you had to have some reference to tennis. So Michael Wilson and myself, when we were devising the sequence, we looked for a place that we could use a forehand smash and a overhead smash and whatever during one of the fight sequences, and that happened during one of the scenes, and I was able to use the policeman in the middle of the road, for instance, reacting as he would react to a tennis match, you know, left, right, left, right, left, right. All these little gags came into it. We always had about 5,000 people around us at wherever we went, and we'd ask for a crowd scene, and we'd pay, and we'd specify we wanted 500 people, and 5,000 would turn up. And that presented a lot of problems, because sometimes there wasn't any room to maneuver without hurting people, you know. Of course, they have their own film industry, and of course it is reputed to be the largest film industry in the world, and I've seen quite a few Indian films, and some of them go on for 4 or 5 hours, you know. There was no local film industry as such. It's all based in certain centres, and they weren't near us. We did use as many local Indian production facilities as we could, local, we call it local labour, but in fact people had to be bussed in and flown in from all over the place. We built the market on the set of Pinewood. Peter Lamont and his team produced a really authentic looking Indian marketplace. We had all the references, etc. It was impossible really in Udaipur to actually shoot some of those intricate scenes in detail, mainly because of the huge numbers of people that surrounded us all the time. Excuse me. Of course, we were very fortunate to have John Barry back to do the music, and any Bond fan will tell you there's something about John Barry's music and Bond films that really go together. And I was very, very pleased. I hadn't worked with John since on the Majesty's Secret Service. We'd missed him badly. And although we'd had some very fine musicians come in and do our films, somehow John Barry was like the originator, you know, the original. And he gave something to the scenes which I don't think any other composer could ever possibly do. It was just part of him, and I think he shared the same excitement that we all did with the Bond movies.
Easy come, easy go.
It certainly pays to advertise.
This way, James.
Ah, Q. How are you?
Most unhappy.
Good fun in Q's workshop, of course. You know, I mean, Desmond, the wonderful, memorable character who provided a huge amount of fun, not only for the audience, but for the crew that worked with him. A very generous man, and the man who spent a large time during the war as a prisoner in Germany.
Anything else? Oh,
that's okay. An interesting story. He went for a publicity tour to Germany, and the interviewer asked him if he'd visited Germany before, and he smiled and said, oh yes, he said, I was a guest here for 5 years.
Keeping it up, Q.
Experimental model.
Smithers?
Commander?
Smashing, Q.
Come along. I've got a few things for you.
Very nice, Smithers.
Thank you. Is the homing device ready yet, Q?
Not only a homing device, but an extremely delicate microphone as well. Goes in there like that. Now, take a fountain pen. Twist the top. And a highly concentrated mixture of nitric and hydrochloric acid dissolves all metals.
Wonderful for poison pen, that is.
Pay attention, 007. Now, pull the top off the pen. Now, with this ultra-sensitive earpiece, you can listen in on the bug. The homing device is compatible with the standard-issue radio directional finder in your watch. If you haven't lost it.
Technology is improving all the time, and new things, new gadgets were coming in all the time. And in America and Japan, they were producing these TV wristwatches at that time. It was sort of a gimmick. You could hardly see anything, but they did actually work, funnily enough. I think it was a crystal screen, and it was something we wanted to be. If there was something new coming out, it had to be in a Bond movie. So, we incorporated this technology into the script, and we had sort of fake wristwatches made, and we actually placed the images on by trickery, shall we say. It was done in the post-production. We just had a little black screen and made a mat, and in the post-production we inserted the image that we wanted to. But, of course, one of the problems is that you have to keep the... you have to keep the watch perfectly still, so quite often the actor's hand was in a vice while we were shooting the watch, which could be very uncomfortable. There was a very romantic scene between Christina Weyborn and Roger Moore by the swimming pool, beautifully lit by Alan Hume, our cameraman. And we had a Miss World in the scene as well.
I'm glad.
Are you?
Well, let's put it this way. Up to now, you are the least lethal and by far the prettiest of Kamau's friends that I've come across.
Thank you.
So, does he have a proposition for me, or do you?
He suggests the trade. The egg for your life.
Well, I'd heard the price of eggs was going up, but isn't that a little high?
Charge it to room.
Oh, 27. Along with the champagne, I suppose.
I leave it at the desk. You don't mind.
Why has Kamau forgotten what I look like already?
It's for me.
So that if I should depart this world, suddenly you'll have something to remember me by?
Something like that.
The interesting thing about Christine Weyborn's costume, she wore a sari in the film, and there was a very good reason for it. I'd always thought that the sari would be a great way to escape from an upper window, shall we say, rather like you do with bed sheets, knotted bed sheets. And I got together with the costume designer, and we got some very strong material, shall we say, reinforced material. At the same time, it looked absolutely beautiful. And Christine then just winds down from the bedroom window to escape. She just does a... And she's very athletic, Christine. And, we practiced this in the studio, and she was very adept at it. She just fell out of the window backwards, and without a problem. No stunt girl involved. Although in the exterior scene we used a stunt girl.
Forgive my curiosity.
Kind of worked for us very well. The octopusy on her back was a transfer, but it had to be done properly, and we had an artist there with a brush making sure it looked authentic. The Rolls Royce that Kamau Khan uses belonged to the Maharaja. All the Maharaja seem to have wonderful collections of old cars, classic cars, and they're in beautiful conditions because they don't really do any miles. You know, the roads are very limited, and some of these cars haven't got 5,000 miles on the clock. You know, incredible with the age of the cars. I think that possibly India was the most exotic location, certainly, that we've ever used, and presented us with fantastic opportunities for something new. The thing is, when you make Bond movies, you have to be original. You can't produce an action sequence which people have seen on television. You know, it has to be something that only you can do on film, and only a Bond company can actually have the resources to do that type of stunt. And we're always looking for something original. It's very, very difficult to do. And the Sari, I think, gave us that opportunity.
Beautiful view, isn't it? I don't know how to say goodbye.
Actions speak louder than words.
You're so right.
It was a good opportunity here to use this love boat which Mike Turk had built with John Richardson, and it was, although it was appears to be powered by these beautiful girls, in fact there was a discreet engine hidden away somewhere underneath, which just gave them a bit of assistance, shall we say. A lot of the actual shots here were shot at the Lake Palace Hotel, and the where the unit was staying. It was it doubled as a place where we slept and we ate and we relaxed. We used the the shortest travelling time to any location I've ever been on. I think we just rolled out of bed and you were on the set. Very, very nice place, very romantic place. Maud Adams played the lead in the movie, and we'd considered all kinds of different actresses throughout the world to play the part of Octopussy. And at the end of the day, Cubby turned to me and he said, "Of all the girls we've seen, there's no one as beautiful as Maud." And it's been some time now since she appeared in a Bond movie, and I met her recently in Hollywood, he said, and she looked absolutely fabulous. And decision we made there and then that Maud would be the first, I think, first girl to appear in two Bond movies, although she was made a fleeting appearance in another one I did, which was View to a Kill. So that's a good trivia question for you. The blue-ringed Octopussy that we featured in the film, in fact, they do exist. I've never heard of a tame one, mind you, so we decided we'd have to make our own octopus. And John Richardson, our specialist effects supervisor, and his team produced a wonderful blue-ringed octopus that that was worked on air, I believe, and it manipulated its tentacles and was a great prop in the movie. Supposed to be a deadly creature, and one of John's assistants became absolutely expert at pumping it up with enough air to make it look really natural. I remember some years later that a friend of mine at the golf club said, "I was cursing you the other day." He said, "My son," he said, "asked to see the Bond movie, and I took him to see it. And when the octopus came out of the tank, my son covered his eyes because he was so frightened, and next day he said, "Would you take me to see it again so I can see the octopus?" And the second time he went to see it, the kid covered his eyes again. On the third time, I think his father held his hand so he couldn't cover his eyes so he could see it and stop seeing my movie. The scenes at the Summer Palace were very interesting. We used the exteriors. With foreground, we built the foreground bars and the windows Peter Lamont supplied, and we shot through those to give the impression that, so we then matched that in the studio, the reverses, and the interior scenes, of course, were shot at Pinewood. Some beautiful workmanship. We're very fortunate we have such clever carpenters and painters and people that really take a pride in their work.
Well, so far I can't complain about the valet service. Dinner, 8 o'clock.
Roger's held kind of captive in Kamel's summer palace. And again, Peter Lamont excelled himself on the set. Complete the chandeliers and circular staircase, which I'd seen the set after Peter had built it, and he'd built the staircase straight. And I said, no, Peter, I must have a circular staircase, because later on, when the action scene comes here, I want Bond to come down, slide down the banister, with it blazing away with his machine gun, and I must have a curved staircase. So it was back to the drawing board, and they changed it all for me. The dressings on the table, when you look at it, you go on the set for the first time, and there's all this exotic fruit, displayed, and the prop man, he sprays it all with some kind of solution to keep it fresh looking. So I've often seen people sort of go and steal a grape or something and then spit it out because it tastes so awful. I think the food was incredible, really, when you look at it. When it's revealed to Bond, it's quite a work of art.
A bit crude, very unreliable. We prefer curare with an effective psychedelic compound. Guaranteed results.
But with permanent brain damage.
An unfortunate side effect.
I suppose no dinner scene in an Eastern country is complete without having a sheep's eye on the menu. And that gave us a lot of fun. And the chef at Pinewood Studios did a wonderful job of making a mock sheep eyes, which was edible. It did look very real. I think that to eat it would take a lot of nerve, but provided a nice moment, a nice touch in the film, humour and suspense, I think.
Well, thank you for dinner.
Again, you see the circular staircase is always featured, so that it's established in the audience's mind for later. It's what we call setting up something. You set it up and use it. It's very important that you suggest these things ahead of time, in a way, subconsciously. Then we had, of course, the scene where Bond, you can't keep him in his room for long, although he's locked in. He's not going to be there for very long, is he? And, of course, he makes his way to Christine's room around the balustrade of the balcony. And this was done mainly in the studio of Pinewood. He has to use one of Q's devices, the magic fountain pen, to dissolve, put acid on the bars and dissolve the metal. It's an amazing mix, really, of authentic shots we did in India and close shots of the studio. Anyone walking around a building like that on the balustrade, I use my pigeon, as always, to frighten people. So you get a moment of quiet, and then suddenly a burst of noise makes people jump. And I love to sit at the back of the cinema and see everyone leap in the air about a foot. I think it's quite satisfying in a way to make people react. Hope we don't give anybody a heart attack. Of course, the all the lights go on, and of course the helicopter arrives. Again, Peter was ingenious, and we shot this in Pinewood, on the Pinewood lot. He constructed a helicopter pad, and if you look carefully, you see one or two lights in the background, which we couldn't avoid. But we use this Russian helicopter again, very similar to the one we used on For Your Eyes Only. And of course, my friend Stephen Burkhoff makes his appearance, and I must admit, I love working with him. He's such an extrovert character. He's just right for a Bond movie. This whole sequence was quite intricate in the planning. It develops throughout the scene, lots of suspense, and with Bond finding his way out of the room and outwitting the guards and getting into position to hear what's going on. Very important plot points are discussed here about the egg and going to, the key word I think was going to East Germany, going to a town there. Karl Marxstadt is mentioned, and this gives Bond the motivation, the reason to go to East Germany. Bond uses his Q equipment again. He's got his wristwatch with a location detector on it and a bug with an earpiece. Inside the egg, he's planted a Q device, and it enables him to listen into the conversation.
Good. Have it put aboard the helicopter.
Colonel. Is it a year?
All this was shot in the studio at Pinewood, and some very astute set building, very well lit. And of course, with Stephen Burkhoff, I couldn't resist using the magnifying glass to emphasize his crazy eyes. Unfortunately, like everything else, all best plans go wrong, and the hairdryer interferes with his sound and frustrates him from picking up vital information. The bomb that's loaded onto the helicopter is first shown here, and again was over to a combination between the art department and John Richardson to get a piece of equipment that really appeared to work. Of course, it has to look absolutely authentic and be beautifully engineered.
Everything taken care of?
As you ordered, Excellence.
So, you recovered it?
From an accomplice of the thief.
He must be eliminated. At once.
Naturally.
There must be no further security breach. This fake has caused enough trouble.
Terrible moment when the Fabergé egg is smashed and Louis recovers the bug. Knows that someone's been listening.
Everything has been most satisfactory. You are most kind, General Olaf.
Get Bond.
Now, of course, Bond finds himself locked in the cold store, which is not a very pleasant place to spend the night, I must say. Again, to make all the props look authentic, you know, all the frozen meat, etc. We did with a kind of a paint. We sprayed on a kind of a frosting, if you like. And Roger has to find a way out. You know, you can't go to India and not use elephants. Michael Wilson and myself and Dick Maybaum, when we were going through, we tried to, you know, put scenes in the film which would relate to India. And this whole sequence, you know, being Bond being carried out as though he's a dead man in a sack. I mean, it's high humour, isn't it, really, as well as being rather, you know, the spooky in the fact that these chaps are dumping the bodies on the rubbish dump, and they dump Roger out, and he suddenly comes to life, and it's great fun, and the kids love that stuff. And then, of course, we're suddenly in the Maharani's garden.
Good. Let the sport commence.
The Maharaja hosted us at a cocktail party, and before we started shooting. And as I walked in into his palace, the first thing I noticed was a stuffed tiger in the hallway. So when I engaged him in conversation, I just jokingly said to him, "You know, could we borrow your tiger?" And he agreed. He said, "Yeah, absolutely. Help yourself." So I spoke to the prop man, and we went and borrowed the tiger, and mounted it on a wheelbarrow, and that's what we used in the movie. We just ran it through a bush, and Roger did his stuff. Sit. And then, of course, we went back to Pinewood and recreated a bit of the jungle, and we managed to get the Jimmy Chipperfield to produce a couple of tigers for us, and managed to do that stuff. And of course, you know, you use animals. There was a funny story, I think, with the tiger. When we were on the stage, the trainer said, you know, if the animal gets out of the cage, whatever you do, don't run, just keep perfectly still. And the second unit were doing the shot, Arthur was photographing it, the tiger, prowling through the undergrowth, and he got his camera sort of adjacent to the cage, shooting between the bars, when suddenly the tiger leapt 8 feet in the air, leapt straight out of the cage onto the stage. And within seconds, the only people that were visible was Barbara Broccoli and the continuity girl, who just stood their ground. They listened to the tiger, but I'm sure they were pretty scared. And I think the tiger was pretty scared as well. The chase, the hunt through the jungle was really fun to do, and I love working with animals. And the howdahs that are placed on top of the elephants are very rocky. If you ever ride in one, it's not as smooth as it looks. One of the stuntmen we were using on the film was Cubby's son-in-law, Pat Banta, who was a male model, very successful in Hollywood, but also a very good athlete, a great swimmer, great climber. We used him in several films. He did something that Johnny Weissmuller did very well, but not many stuntmen can do, and that is actually to perform the Tarzan feat of swinging from tree to tree on a vine. It's very hard on the arms, but Pat succeeded very well. And later on, we got the Tarzan sound from MGM in Hollywood, put it over, and it was great. Because no jungle film would be complete without a leech. My mind always goes back to Shepperton Studios when I was a kid there, and they were filming with Humphrey Bogart and Catherine Hepburn out on the lot, and they constructed a very similar set, and we used crocodiles and all sorts. The lake itself is quite beautiful in this area. Before we went shooting there, I was asked when I was on the reconnaissance by the medical people to take samples of water. And I asked Alan Hume if he would be kind enough to... he volunteered to collect samples of water from the lake, from the hotel, from the bottled water, so they could be analysed in London before our unit set out for India. And the lake was absolutely lethal, apparently, although the local kids always swam in it. We worry about the Thames, but we had nothing to worry about. The bottled water wasn't too good either, and the best water was actually in the tap, believe it or not.
Produces a venom that's invariably fatal in seconds.
Another actor that we used, who had been in a previous Bond movie, The Spy Who Loved Me, played the part of Sadruddin. That was Albert Moses. We brought him in from England, and he played a good role for us.
Here, that island's full of beautiful women. No men allowed.
Really? Sexual discrimination. I'll definitely have to pay it a visit.
I think the piece de resistance was the crocodile. I mean, John Richardson and his team constructed this device, which was like a little miniature boat with a little windscreen on it and everything. And again, Roger raised his eyebrows more than usual, if you like, when he saw that device. And he said, "I'm going in that." And I said, "Oh, yeah, it'll be a wonderful device." So it got a huge laugh, and indeed it did. Not only did he get a huge laugh when the jaws opened to reveal Roger, but they also got an equally large laugh at the end when the jaws snapped shut again. Great device, and something that, you know, just comes out of thinking, what could we possibly use here on the lake?
Good evening. I wondered when you might arrive.
So you are the mysterious Octopussy.
And you are James Bond, 007, licensed to kill. Am I to be your target for tonight?
Well, not necessarily. Depends how much you tell me about jewelry smuggling.
And why one... It's strange when you look at these films, Dan. You dodge from... location in India to the studio in Pinewood, with that's absolutely seamless. I mean, it gives you an idea of the skill that's involved, not only with the production designer, but all the people that work on the movie that make it look real, the people who dress the sets. The octopus is always featured, of course, and it's always there as a menacing. You know, again, that you're setting it up for a scene that's going to happen later on. Which I was a bit worried about initially, how we were going to get this octopus to actually perform, if you like, when it attacks the man. But in fact, it's amazing really how an object like that, if the man is a good actor, can make it appear that the octopus is attacking him, and in fact it's the other way around. It's the man who's manipulating the octopus.
He was my father. I'd hoped fate would bring us together one day.
To avenge him?
No, to thank you for giving him an honorable alternative. Come in.
It was very important to have a variety, different variety of girls surrounding Octopussy, and I wanted the long and the short of it, and Cherry Gillespie was the short of it, shall we say. She used to be with a pop group.
Well, I'd like you to meet my new house guest.
An old friend of the family, you might say.
How lovely. You have a nasty habit of surviving.
Well, you know what they say about the fittest.
Octopussy, I would enjoy another opportunity to take care of Mr. Bond personally.
I will take care of Mr. Bond myself.
Good night.
Now, we were very conscious always of trying to keep the Fleming story going, all the characters and the wonderful feeling that he gave to his stories, and every opportunity we got, we'd run out of. We only had the short stories now to work with, but we used to develop them, and sometimes we used bits and pieces from other Fleming things. It's just a question of making it as authentic as possible. It's very difficult to imitate Fleming, really. I mean, it's a great sadness that he didn't write more books, really.
Show Mr. Bond to his room. Good night, Mr. Bond.
I know that one day, when we were shooting the scene with Roger and Maud, Maud brought her mother down on the set, and she must have been well into her 70s. Most beautiful, elegant woman. And I said to Maud, I can see where you got your good looks from. Another interesting prop that we used was the device that Kamal Khan used, his henchmen used. It was the nearest thing I could find to a yo-yo. I always remember the kids with the yo-yos going up and down, and I spoke to John Richardson and said I was very anxious to use something that the children could relate to, if you like, and would recognize. And he devised this most fantastic prop, which actually worked. It did work like a yo-yo. It was like a circular saw that came down and returned to the sender, if you like, and it actually did it. And after the movie was finished and it worked so successfully, John mounted it on a wooden plate and presented it to Cubby Broccoli as a memento of the film. The scenes that we did with Q on the riverbank, we didn't take Q to India, I don't think, and we had to recreate his scenes with a double and do the reverses at Pinewood Studio.
Permission to smuggle a consignment of diamonds. I discovered I had a talent for it.
So you went into business for yourself?
Yes, but I needed an organization, so I revived the old octopus cult.
Well then, where did you recruit all these lovelies?
There are many of them. All of us.
I think the scenes in Octopus's Palace, which we, you know, we shot the there were two islands, I'd better explain, at Udaipur. One island, the Lake Palace Hotel was situated on, which was very exotic. And the second island was kind of disused. It still had the most beautiful landing stages, and certain superficial parts of it were still there, and Peter Lamont refurbished everything there that he could, the landing stage, etc., and the entrance onto the island was still in pretty good shape. But fortunately for us, it had got a bit overgrown, and it had a terrific character. I remember that we shot, for instance, the birds used to roost in one of the trees on the island, and I got someone to fire a gun and take a photograph of all these birds rising in the sky, which was very dramatic. Something that I love to use these things to make people jump, and it worked very, very well indeed. I suppose when you look at some of the sets, you realise that it's a production designer's dream to have a film set here. The colours are so beautiful, and it just gets people away from their humdrum lives sometimes. If you're looking at one of these movies and, you know, you're in the depths of an English winter or an American winter, shall we say, just suddenly you're transported, aren't you? You just start to think about your holidays, really. One thing that Peter did, which was absolutely fantastic, is Octopus's bed. I'll never forget when this came on the screen to an audience for the first time, the huge reaction it got. It's only on the screen for a split second, but they get it straight away. I mean, I guess they Bond audiences expect this sort of thing, but I was amazed at the reaction that it had. Saddest scenes, if you like, was the exit of VJ. He said to me, "You're not going to kill me, are you?" I said, "Well, you know, it happens in movies. Don't take it personally." But the idea of these guys appearing out of nowhere was good, and it was a great surprise. Again, the yo-yo was used. And the birds accentuate the drama. I love to use things like that to not show the violence. I mean, I think that, you know, Bond movies are basically a family movie, and I think it's more dramatic, funnily enough, to show a death of someone by cutting to away at that particular point to something else unrelated, but a startled bird or a flock of birds taking off, anything that kind of creates a scream and hides the reality of the violence.
Something wrong?
Not really.
The man that played the part of the who wields the yo-yo was a very nice man. He wasn't really an actor. He was more of an athlete, I guess. He was someone we chose because of his stature. And on the set of Pinewood, we constructed a balcony. And from this balcony, the man was going to hurl the yo-yo down at Bond. And unknown to anyone on the crew, this man had gone along and taken away the supporting struts for the superstructure because they interfered with his him walking around the balcony. So he, on his own volition, decided to remove these struts. He probably asked someone to do it, and no one knew about it. But if he'd consulted the art department, they could have told him that the structure was now unsafe. And when he put his weight against it, in the middle of the take, the balustrade gave way, and he hurtled towards the ground. The stunt arranger on that particular scene was Paul Weston. I shall never forget the quickness of mind of Paul when he saw that man actually falling. While we all stood open mouth watching it happen, Paul rushed out into the set and shoulder charged him as he hit the ground and broke his fall and saved him from really serious injuries. I mean, he did break an arm, but that's pretty serious, but it could have been a lot worse. He could have broken his neck if Paul hadn't responded so quickly. Cooks, when when women have to fire guns on stage, you know, the great thing is for them not to close their eyes. And, you know, I think they did pretty well. I think Maud did pretty well as well. There's an interesting story with the crocodile or alligator we used. When he arrived at Pinewood Studios, where Peter Lamont had constructed a set with a tank, and the crocodile duly arrived in a tank and with its trainer. Unfortunately, it was going through a period of hibernation and was very, very inactive. In fact, he was fast asleep. But the show has to go on, so we tried heating the water up to no avail. And eventually we managed to get the creature into the water. And I said to the handler, we have to dress you up double for Roger Moore, and you're going to have to wrestle with the crocodile and make it appear that the crocodile is in fact wrestling with you. And that worked very, very well. After we completed the sequence, they went to put the crocodile back in its tank, which to transport it back away from the studios. And it suddenly woken up and disappeared into the set underneath all the underneath all the wire netting, and it was impossible to get him out. And for 2 weeks, that creature was in hibernation under the set of Pinewood Studios and didn't want to leave. Eventually, they took the set down and exposed the crocodile, and they were able to recover him.
Karl Marx studies further east.
The scenes in Berlin were interesting because, again, we were in the height of the Cold War, and we had to do a scene at Checkpoint Charlie, which was quite nervous, actually, a nervous moment for us, really, because the place was heavily guarded. And, you know, I wanted to be authentic. I wanted to show the real Checkpoint Charlie. It was quite a famous crossing point, and a lot of people knew it. And I guess we could have reconstructed it. But, in fact, there is a little bit of no man's land that you can go through. So in fact we actually drove through and then turned over and then turned round in the no man's land bit and headed straight back into West Berlin. An interesting city, particularly at that time. You know, you see the Brandenburg Gate very clearly, and all the this ugly wall that went round. Thank goodness that's down now. And it's hard to believe when you look back on the situation at that time. The filming of the circus was very, very interesting. Peter Lamont constructed a big top on the set at Pinewood, and we shot outside. We had a very big crowds, you know, over 500 people, a lot of children involved. So it was a big production for us to manage. Also, the knife-throwing twins have to actually perform. And we did that with a series of techniques. We probably used a dummy of the guy turning around on the thing with the actual, just to get one shot where you see both twins together. And then we did shots of the knife on the turntable. We did it in reverse, if I remember right. We took the knives out instead of putting them in. Always intercut. It's very useful, having been an editor, actually, that you can actually break these things down into small segments and shoot them that way to perfect them. Certainly, the catching the knife was done in reverse, which is always a useful trick, and old as the hills, actually, in terms of technique. But these old tracks still work, you know. They've been, Buster Keaton used them, and we still use them. A stuntman that I'd known for many years and worked on several Bond pictures was Dickie Graydon, or Lord Graydon, as he was sometimes known. And he was quite a small in stature. And I thought it would be ideal for my vision of the man that's fired from the cannon. And suddenly I was talking to the costume designer about what he should be wearing, and I'd always visualised him as having these gossamer wings. And, of course, Dickie Grayton, and it was a great opportunity for him to star. And he took full advantage of it. He was absolutely perfect for it. And it's quite useful, in fact, having a stuntman to perform this role. The fact that we could actually, well, we didn't fire him out of the cannon, but he appeared to be fired out of the cannon. We had some sort of spring device loaded inside that gave him the momentum. And then we actually fired a dummy from the cannon, and it worked very well indeed. In fact, that all the circus stuff was absolutely fantastic. We had to get a ringmaster. We had to bring in acts from all over Europe, you know, to fill in. We had the elephants came from Germany. A wonderful elephant trainer there came along, and he was so concerned about his elephants and how he fed them. I mean, the logistical problems for Tom Bevsner were quite amazing, and they overcame them, and all the animals were very comfortable and made a fuss of by the crew. I know the German trainer, for instance, created, we were doing that scene, Octopus's Palace, and the ramp that we needed for the elephants to come up had to be strengthened because the German trainer was worried that the elephants would crash through the wood with their extreme weight. So we had to beef up all the ramp so that they could gain access to the stage.
Just arrived from Leningrad.
Drama of star.
The Romanov star.
The construction of the bomb was very good, and it had to be portable, and it had to appear to be authentic. And Peter did a lot of research, Peter Lamont, and to make sure it worked. All the electronics were done by a specialist firm, and had to be welded into the compartment in the train. We used the Nene Valley Railway as a location for the train sequence, and it's a private railway, and it has authentic trains that would have been used in East Germany at that time. They were still using steam engines there because they had lots of coal and the economy was very poor. One of the scenes called for Roger to hide under the train, and he has to sort of pick himself up and cling to the underside of the train as it goes in the tunnel. I wanted to get shots of Roger as it approached the tunnel, and we had to make a rig. Chunky Hughes, our grip, constructed a very clever rig under the train, made of scaffold poles, and because I was worried about the weight, I suggested that I didn't go on it, that, you know, I just had Roger in position and, you know, the camera crew, two men and the camera slung underneath the train as it entered the tunnel. And when I suggested this to Roger, he said, if you don't go on it, I'm not going on it. So I also had to go on it. But I was just worried about the extra weight. Ha ha. The tunnel at in the Nene Valley Railway suited us perfectly. It was quite a long tunnel, and it was the ideal place for them to switch the bomb and to continue into with the circus, so it comes back into West Germany. Again, the circus element helps us a lot. You know, the fact they're transporting all the props from the circus gives you great opportunities.
And twist the lever a quarter turn clockwise. Be at least 20 miles away when it goes off.
I didn't really ever get a first draft of the script of Octopus E. I mean, I was involved with its development right from the word go, right when George MacDonald Fraser was writing the story, and we had a completely different story. We used certain parts of it. I think probably the element about India probably came into our equation, because George MacDonald Fraser has written a lot of Flashman books about India, and that was where the first inkling about India came in. So, I mean, I worked on you know, the developing the story, not as closely as Michael Wilson would do with, I think Richard Maybaum came in later on. And they were, you know, worked out. But at the same time that they were working on the script, I was working on the action development, dreaming up the pre-title scene and stuff like that, and casting it. So the two operations go on simultaneously, and that's also coupled with location records, where we go around the world and look for likely locations, get ideas, come back, incorporate them in the script. So it's quite unique, a Bond film. You don't really start with a script. You start with an idea, which can change completely after, you know, maybe 2 or 3 weeks or 4 weeks. I enjoyed working with George MacDonald Fraser. I'm a very talented chap, and quite a few of his ideas were retained in the film. Nice man to work with. One of Bob Simmons' proteges was Martin Grace. Martin was a fantastic athlete. Bob was kind of training him to take over when Bob couldn't do it anymore, and it was reaching that stage. And Martin was chosen to double for Bond as he climbs along the outside of the train. It was basically a second unit operation. My second unit director, Arthur Worcester, was in charge of it, and Martin had checked the railway line and made sure that the section of track that we were using was clear of obstructions, because this was a kind of an amateur operation, the railway, and they used volunteers and to maintain the track and what have you. And so when we came to do these shots, you know, it was very important. Safety is always a very important factor with when you're doing dangerous sequences. And Martin was in the middle of doing the sequence, and Arthur was filmed from the helicopter. There must have been a breakdown in communication, because they exceeded the stretch that they had previously checked out, and there was an obstruction on the line. And Martin Grace was felled by a piece of pipe that stuck out, and he was struck. The train was probably doing 25 miles an hour, 30 miles an hour. We rushed him to hospital by helicopter, and I went to see him a few days later, and he was sitting up in bed and being cheerful, which is a wonderful part of his character. But he was out of action for the rest of the movie, unfortunately, and eventually made a complete recovery. But they're the sort of accidents one must always avoid if possible.
Why is that bomb on the train?
The following days were a bit fraught, really, with Martin so seriously hurt, and we had to pick ourselves up and dust ourselves off and keep going. The film must go on. Paul Weston took over Martin's role, you know, running around on the train, outside the train, and he did a great job, particularly considering what had happened. And the sequence was finished and was completed on time. I think that whole sort of train area is always very exciting in Bond movies. We've used them in, you know, Russia with Love and Spy Love Me, and now on Octopussy. Cubby had he particularly liked trains. He found them exciting, and I think most people do, particularly steam trains. The actual escape from the train, where you know, where Bond leaps off the train. When you look at some of the stuntmen, you know, you realise what a dangerous job it is they do, and how light-hearted they are about it. You know, they just do it as their job. Amazing. So, well, some people do for a living.
Jason!
One of the scenes that I've always been keen on, a good, great visual gag, is a car on a railway track. You know, if you can kind of go out of the norm, you expect to see a train on the track. When you see a car on the track, it's kind of funny, you know. And the Mercedes didn't exactly fit the railway track. We had to kind of make a modification slightly. John Richardson's a great engineer, he did that. And, you know, the idea of the Mercedes catching up with the train and transferring was appealed to me greatly, and it also lends itself for the finale, where the scene where the Mercedes is wiped out by an express train coming in the opposite direction. That's always a shock, you know, and we achieved the shot of the express train coming. We used a mirror on the train, so that we got the impression that the two were coming together. Peter Lamont again supplied a full-length mirror and enabled us to do this shot here, which is the train coming. It was reflected into a mirror. Then John Richardson fired the Mercedes from an air ram, which is a huge air cannon, and the car is actually fitted with a long shaft into this hydraulic machine, and it's pumped up under terrific pressure and released. And I think it was Dickie Graydon was another one of the stuntmen that was in the boat on the lake, and John Richardson, who's an expert at this, he's really cut it quite fine. It actually just clipped the boat. I mean, it couldn't have been better timing, but if I'd been one of the stuntmen, I'd have been very worried.
Kamal Khan says we have to stay here until we cross the border.
The license plate is General Orloff's. We have discovered this.
Where is General Orloff now?
He was last reported heading towards the border.
Of course, Stephen Berkoff has his death scene in this area of the film, and true to life, when he read the script and he saw what I was planning to do with the train, I mean, he was so enthusiastic about it. And the great thing about Stephen is to keep him within bounds, shall we say, because he has such a wide range. He's such a fine actor. He can do anything, and he sort of tests you in a way. He tries things, and I love that with an actor. He experiments, and sometimes you like it, sometimes you don't, you know. And sometimes you have to say to him, "Look, take it down a bit, Steve, and it's a little bit over the top." Walter Gotell also had an accident here. We were doing the scene where they arrive at the border crossing, and Walter Gotell arrives by helicopter, and he runs after the train, and railway sleepers are not the best things to run on, quite honestly. And you know, with the chippings in between the sleepers, it makes for bad footing. And In one of the scenes, Walter stumbled and fell and cut his face badly. But what a pro, you know. We patched him up and put some makeup on it, and he was back there in within half an hour, you know. The animal skin thing really appealed to me. I don't know, I must have a childish sense of humour, I think, but it was an opportunity too good to miss, getting Roger to hide in the ape skin. Was, I think, very, very funny, and something I love to do. I mean, it's humour is quite amazing, really. You have to with a Bond movie, you can go so far. You mustn't cross a line to vaudeville, but you can get pretty close to it sometimes. And I love visual humour, and this film provided great moments.
I take it none of you will be late.
Sure that Octopussy is one of my favourite films to shoot, purely because there's such a variety and so many opportunities, you know, for the imagination. Some very clever stunt work with them, you know, on top of the train with the bridges going past. Sometimes he has to leap over a pipe and goes underneath a bridge and then coupled with all the circus performers on the train, and Octopussy in her stateroom, and just a feeling of luxury and excitement. I don't think there's anything particularly original about leaping from one carriage to another. It's been done on quite a few films now, but it's still pretty dangerous to do. During the scene on the train where Kabir Bedi and Bond are fighting, and Bond finds himself again under the train or between the carriages, Peter came up with an amazing solution. He actually got the carriages brought from the Nene Valley, transported into the studio, and he had these huge cranes which suspended them about 4 feet off the ground. And then, because we put a moving backing on the floor, and we just painted railway sleepers and track on the backing, and that moved along. And John Richardson put motors on the wheels of the train to give the feeling of the train moving. And you know, just amazing, really, how authentic that looks. And it was very workable. It was difficult for Roger because, you know, to be suspended under the train like that requires, you'd soon run out of energy, you know, just keeping yourself lifted up there. So we constructed a rig for him with wires so that it took the weight of his body, and he was able to act with all this other stuff going on, because it was really a technical sequence. And to achieve the sparks when Kabir Bedi is striking out with a sword, we ran a wire down Kabir's arm connected to the sword, connected to a 12 volt battery, and every time he shorted out against the any metal parts of the train, the sparks would erupt. So again, that was an old device that's been used for donkey's years, and it's a device that works just as well now as it did with, you know, in the old days. So these old techniques are very, very useful to know. Also, the use of steam is great, you know, because it hides the multitude of sins, shall we say. You know, you get away with a lot of things, in little imperfections. You put a bit of steam over the scene. And also Lewis Gilbert taught me, you know, like, it's a very useful device to get a fan to blow the steam. It gives you a great sense of movement. Whether it's outside an aeroplane window or wherever you're trying to fake something to look as though you're moving, steam's a very useful device to use. And also CO2 under pressure is also very useful, because that dissipates very quickly. At one point, Kabir Bedi severs one of the connections, one of the hoses between the carriages, and the steam hose, which backwards and forwards, scalding anyone who got in the way, is superheated steam. So that produced more suspense, and we kind of take advantage of every possibility when we draw these scenes up, when we invent these scenes. We just think of anything that could happen or anything that could go wrong, and take full advantage of it. Thing when I was in the Air Force, I always remember we used to hitchhike back from Lincolnshire to London, and several times I would hitch a ride, and a guy would in a car would stop, and I'd run up the road to try and catch the lift, and just as I got close to him, he'd drive away. And some people think that's really funny. I think it's horrible, but I used it in the movie. The idea came from that.
Govinda will stay with the jewelry.
Boys, come.
Thank you, Liebchen.
Schnell a bit of
schnell. Yeah. Marshall's shop. Gut.
Ein Bier?
Ganz schön sehr freundlich.
Yeah, thanks, the bad job.
We were fortunate that on the Pinewood lot there was remnants of a set that had been built for another film, a Bavarian village, and we were able to use the scene where Bond is trying to make an urgent phone call, and of course there's always someone on the phone and refuses to get off. So all those sort of frustrations you meet in life, we try and incorporate in the movie. I remember the girl that played the actress that played that part was very, very good, and obviously was very experienced at making phone calls. Anyway, he stole her car, so she got her own. She got her just desserts, I suppose. And then we started the chase, which we shot mainly in Germany. Remy Julien, of course, and his team were the drivers. And I was amazed at the cooperation the German police gave us. And of course, there's no speed limit on their autobahns, so you can go as fast as you like. The point is that everyone else is going fast, so you've got to go even faster. But the cooperation was great, and Remy and his team are such fantastic drivers, and we were actually going down the autobahn at one stage, going at a huge speed, and we were actually what the other people on the motorway thought, I don't know, because we were actually doing all our stunt work and overtaking, and lights were flashing and sirens were screaming and motorcycles and cars all going on, and no one seemed to take much notice.
Hey,
basically, on a Bond movie, almost every scene where you see the main actors, that's the first unit. Anything with doubles, leaping off trains and things, which are so time-consuming, you have to do with a what we call a supplementary unit, a second unit. And we send them off, and if they have to do it three times, fine. You know, it doesn't cost a fortune. But with the first unit, we're so heavy on people and personnel and time, and dealing with the main actors, that you have to stick to your schedule, because people are brought on for a few days and in their contract, and if they go over time, then of course you have to pay more money, and that's what the bottom line is. That's what it's about, money, isn't it? We then moved up to Upper Hayford, to the Air Force base there, and the American Air Force authorities gave us wonderful cooperation. It was a kind of a critical time there, because there was protesters outside the gate protesting against nuclear weapons, and the Greenpeace people were there in force and camped out, and they didn't really make life too difficult for us, but we were very much aware of them, and they were a presence there all the time. The Upper Hayford authorities gave us full use of we couldn't stop them flying. We didn't want to stop them flying. I mean, their planes were constantly in the background of our shots, and it was a nuclear base, and security was pretty strict, but they gave us wonderful cooperation. I mean, and you think, what's the stake? It's amazing.
Where can I find the base commander? It's urgent.
Let's see your circus pass.
Damn it, man, I said it's urgent.
Get out with your hands up! They're showing us auto! Captain, some nut went through here in a stolen car. Wants the base commander. And he's wearing a red shirt.
In the big sequence, approaching the finale, where the bomb is placed in the cannon. Was another gigantic scene, really, which took a tremendous amount of organisation. And you know, when you're dealing with these big crowd scenes, you have to make sure you shoot the crowd. You know, you actually make sure you get the value. Sometimes, you know, you get a shot where you can do it without the crowds, and you should, you know, you leave those shots until such times as you haven't got the people around. Of course, when I suggested to Roger that he should be disguised as a clown, again he looked at me and raised a few eyebrows. The thing is that I thought it'd be a perfect disguise for him, and he could handle it. You know, even to go to the whole extent, you know, with the red nose and the white face. I mean, and he did. He did it absolutely brilliantly, and he wondered sometimes of the things I was getting him into, I'm sure. But it made a good disguise. It enabled him to gain access. There's some very amusing moments in the circus. I mean, you know, when Roger comes, passes another clown dressed exactly the same, you know, it's like confusing. Which is the one? Which is the imposter? Which is the real one? All this stuff, I think, again, dealing with kind of a non-professional crowd. There were some professional extras in the crowd, but a lot of them were kids and people who, you know, it's difficult to get 500 people. The trick is to keep them amused all day, you know, so they don't get bored. You know, they get bored very quickly. It goes on for two or three days. And it's quite good that some of the acts went on to keep them amused in between our shooting, because it isn't every shot that you involve them, but you try to, of course, from a point of economics.
He'll destroy the entire operation.
Any suspense film, you've got a bomb that's ticking away, You milk it for what it's worth, you know, and it always works. The audience, you suddenly find the audience is sitting there holding their breath. You know, they get completely caught up in it. And what you have to do as a director, you have to make sure that everyone knows what the bomb is going to do if it does reach zero, you know, and it counts down. And the fact that it was such a brilliant looking piece of machinery made it look authentic. And if it went off, you know, gone, you know, that was it. We'd all be out of here. So the relief, and immediately after the bomb reaches the critical point, and Bond manages, of course, to save the world, you have to pay it off with a laugh. And we did that very neatly, I think, using Dickie Graydon, you know, campaign, you know, popping out of the cannon. Just gives people an excuse to laugh, to release their tension, and that is very important.
Where was Kamal going? Back to India.
Folks, we've had an emergency, but everything is all right now. You and your families are safe. Now, please leave the tent in an orderly manner. Thank you.
The plane is refueled.
We'll take off at sunrise. Are the gold certificates on board?
Yes, Excellence.
We'll take these also. Dollars, pounds, francs, marks. I can always print my own.
So the whole sort of idea of the circus troupe, and that have so many skills, and of course, you know, you can always introduce specialist people, tumblers, Susan Dando, an athletic girl. I mean, she was in there and looked good and performed well. Most of the models, you wouldn't expect them to do anything too death-defying, but they got into it, you know, and they did well. But the girls, getting into the palace, the girls were being, you know, we used athletes. I mean, we had trapeze artists and tumblers and people integrated into our crowd. And we used not only the beautiful girls to distract the guards, but we also used the pyramid to, you know, for the strong girl to be carrying like five or six other girls, and she wasn't that strong actually. She looked strong, but she, like a lot of people, she wasn't. She needed a bit of help. So when you see her struggling and holding that group up in the air, she's, you know, it's sleight of hand again. But they really loved this.
Horses are saddled.
Yes, Excellence.
I'll join you in a few minutes.
Do you really think you can escape me?
You know, another shot that was quite interesting to do was when Q comes to the rescue. And he comes in his hot air balloon, and I did a shot in India of the Knight Castle, beautifully illuminated against an evening sky, and we then used that as a plate, and we put a miniature. John Richardson built a miniature balloon, which we flew on a wire. And we didn't move the camera. We just moved the arm of the camera, and it gave the feeling of the hot air balloon moving towards the palace. Very successful model shot and done very simply, which was a feature really of how we used to approach special effects. We didn't have CGI in those days, computer generated digital effects. So we did it for real, and the beauty is you see it at rushes the next day, and you can see whether it works or it doesn't work. If it doesn't work, you try something else. I love the tumblers. I've always wanted to use tumblers, and they're great, and I think men always find it fun to see a woman punching a man as long as they're not on the receiving end. But the hot air balloon sequence was fun to do, and we actually, apart from the model shot, we actually had the full size balloon, the basket of the balloon anyway, in the studio, and of course Desmond was in his element playing with this stuff, and again it worked very well. I just came in on a crane arm. Some of the Indian stuntmen that we used weren't really professional stuntmen. They'd like to be, I think, but you know, the stuntmen ranks at that time were pretty closed. But some of those Indian guys were really good. The way they fell down the stairs, etc. Great visual humour, which I love. And I see the tiger made another appearance. When Bond escapes from, Bond chases the villains to the airfield, we use an American stuntman who was an expert with transferring from a horse to an aeroplane, and we train this horse to actually work with the aeroplane. I mean, you can't just suddenly get an animal and expect him to chase an aeroplane up a runway. You have to do it slowly and gradually and get him used to the noise. And the American stuntman was fantastic. He, the actual scene was shot in America, believe it or not, and we got the costumes and the doubles and match perfectly. The actual transfer is one of the great stunts, I think. I mean, it's like people just gasp when they saw it. And it's all about time, you know. You give them time to get you, the animal, time to get used to the noise and the wind. Probably the wind more than anything puts the horse off, but it was a wonderful stunt. Intercut somewhere else with Roger Moore on the horse. He's a good horseman, Roger. The same boys that I'd used on previous films, Skydivers, we use the same people to do the climbing about on the outside of the aeroplane. Jake Lombard was a man we'd used before, and we were very fortunate because he was such a great double for Roger. We put on the outside of this aeroplane, which we bought, we put handholds on the outside of various places so he grip. And I was very keen to do loops and rolls, any manoeuvre to throw Bond off the top, and Jake was great, and he just did so well. The aeroplane, funnily enough, We'd bought it for the production, and when I spoke to Peter Lamont about, you know, how we were going to do the studio shots, he decided the best way was to fly the aeroplane over to England. So they went via Greenland, like they used to do during the war, and then flew it out to Denham Airfield, which is near Pinewood Studios. They then negotiated with a local farmer who had an adjoining film to the studio, and we took the hedge down and filled in the ditch and flew it from Denham to Pinewood and actually landed it outside the studio. And then from there it was transported across the road and into the stage. And there we had the same aeroplane in the studio with the backing and using all the old techniques. Sometimes just the backing with steam and smoke we used to use. It'd give a feeling on the speed, but there's some wonderful shots in there. This business of climbing over the aeroplane, it was something that B.J. Worth and Jake used to do when they used to when they were skydiving in America. They would get out and climb all over the aeroplane, and that's where the idea came from. Once you get that idea, then it's very simple to develop the rest of the sequences. There's so many things one can do. One engine had to go out on the plane, which is, it's never a good idea to do with an old aeroplane like that, but he starts to lose power. And then the most interesting thing that happened was when Phil Ressler was shooting the opening sequence with the Beatty jet, while he was there, I was going to get him to do a shot where this aeroplane crashes. We were actually going to write it off. It wasn't the same one, it was very similar. It had one good engine and one bad engine. And we found a Mesa in Montana somewhere, which was 1,000 feet above the ground. And it had been used for rocket testing. And it had a railway on top of the Mesa. And of course it ended with a precipice. And so Phil Ressler got into position and had six cameras working on this. And we got a truck to do 40 miles an hour in the opposite direction, towing the aeroplane to the end of the ramp, the rocket launching ramp. And of course the truck was well out of picture. And the idea was that we had a dummy at the controls, one engine turning over at tick over, the other one dead. And the idea was, of course, that it would crash into the ground and we'd film it on six cameras and get an authentic plane crash. What in fact happened was it came off the end of the rocket ramp, dived towards the ground, got within 100 feet of the ground, straightened out, narrowly missed all the local rocks and boulders that were scattered in the valley floor, and flew away out of sight with the dummy at the controls. Absolutely uncanny. But the cameras, of course, followed it. And we got some of the most exciting footage of a plane missing its wingtips, just missing the mountains by a hair's breadth. It was the most incredible piece of flying I've ever seen, and it was done by a dummy. For an hour or two, had no intention to do.